we're holding on page Yud Zayin in Bava Kamma, about the middle of the page, middle of Os Mem Vav. We started learning yesterday, the Gemara was talking about that when a person steals, it's not just a matter of Dine Mominus, there's a life involved as well. We said Rav Huna and Rav Chista argued whose life is at stake. Is it the Gazlan's that Hashem may decide to deprive him of his life as a punishment for the stealing, or is it the Nigzal, the one he stole from, where he's taking that person's life by stealing from him? And we discussed various psukim on both sides of it. So now the Gemara continues in this vein, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Kol HaGozel Chaveres Shava Pruta, a person steals a Shava Pruta from somebody else, Kilo Noto Neshmasim Imenu, is as if he's taking his Neshama from him. So up until now, we were talking about he steals. We didn't say how much. We could be talking about that he steals $1 million. Now, Rabbi Yochanan wants you to know that even stealing a Pruta can be like taking his life from him. Now, why would that be? So you have a number of Rishonim explained, because we're talking about if the person's poor, that Pruta might have bought him food to keep himself alive, and now the Gazlan is taking it away from him. By the way, a pruta back then went a good deal further than whatever its equivalent is nowadays. We find, for example, there's a Mishnah in Masechta Me'ilah that mentions a case where a person sends somebody to the store with a pruta with two prutas to telling them to buy an esrog, and he comes back with an esrog and a pomegranate. Shows that esrogim were a lot cheaper then too, although I suppose outside of Sukkot time they're probably not any more expensive than any other kind of citrus fruit. But anyway, the point is that you see that a pruta could buy a nice amount of food, relatively speaking, and here he's taking it away from him and he's taking his life. There's another idea of it, b'chlal. You know, we know the whole concept that all the resources that are given to a yid in this world are all for him to be mevarer. So now, if somebody takes away a pruta from him, then he's preventing him from being mevarer that, and in that sense, he's taking away his life from him. He's taking away something of his neshama because he's preventing him from being able to elevate that portion of the world that pertains to his neshama. So Rabbi Yochanan says, Shenema is the pasuk that we quoted before, Kein Ochus Kol Beitzeah Botza, this is the way of all those who steal, Es Nefesh Ba'olav Yikach, he takes the life of the owner, which, as we learned yesterday, one of the ways of understanding that pasuk is that by stealing, he's not just taking the money or the object, he's taking the life of the owner of it with him. The other opinion we said in the Gemara says that Ba'olav means the Gazlan who currently legally owns the thing, nevertheless Hashem may take away his soul as punishment. But here, Rabbi Yochanan is going like the first possibility, that it means that along with the object that he's stealing, he's also stealing the other person's soul. And Rabbi Yochanan goes further, Va'omer, you have another pasuk where also we see a proof from this. And the Gemara is going to explain soon why we need a number of psukim to prove this point. So another pasuk says, the Navi is warning the Jewish people that if they don't do tshuva, then their enemies are going to come and attack, or are going to come and invade and attack Eretz Yisrael and take everything that they own. So he says, Va'ochok sircha v'lachmecha, meaning the enemy army, will eat your harvest and your bread, yoichlu bonecha uvneisecha, they will eat your sons and daughters. Now, we don't mean the invading goyim are not going to be cannibals, but the point is, in other words, that the comparison is, by them eating your harvest and your bread and your food, it'll be as if they're eating your sons and daughters, because as it actually says, now you don't have what to keep them alive with anymore. Now, Marashah says still, I mean, you have other things that are listed in the Pasuk as well there. You have all kinds of things. The Pasuk mentions also he'll eat your sheep and your cattle and your grapevines and so forth. Why is the Gemara Davka focusing on that the stealer, that the them stealing and taking the harvest and the bread is Davka like the sons and daughters? So Marashah says, because if you look in the Pasuk, most of the things are phrased in the singular. And so forth, and he goes through a variety of things, a variety of crops and things that the invading Goyish armies are going, of Nebuchadnezzar, are going to eat. But all of that is in the singular. Then when it comes to Banecho of Nesecha, it's in the plural. Yoichlu Banecho of Nesecha. They will eat. So what does that mean? In other words, the Marashah says, in other words, it means that when they eat the ksilcha v'lachmecha and your various other kinds of food, it's as if it may be only one person, but you feel as though it was so many people, as though you have a bunch of people that are eating your sons and daughters. And again, like Rashi says, because now you don't have anything left to support them with. So we see also the same idea that taking a person's food is tantamount to taking the lives of his children. V'omer, and you have another pasuk, The Navi says that Hashem is going to punish the Goyish nations who throughout all the centuries stole from and harassed the Jewish people. Mechamas b'nei Yehuda, he says that this will be because of the violence that they did against Yehuda. The people of Yehuda, Asher shofchu dam noki ba'aretzam, where these Goyish terrorists and invaders and whatever spilled innocent blood in their land. Means in their land of Eretz Yisrael, in the Jews' land of Eretz Yisrael, in their lands, and the Goyim's lands, in Chutz La'aretz. So we see also, in other words, the point is, the word Hamas is another word for Gezel. Earlier in the Masechta, the Gemara had pointed out that in Lashon Tanakh, Chamas and Gezel are synonyms. They both mean stealing. In Lashon Chazal, they have slightly different meanings, because Chamas means where a person forces the other person to give up something, but then he'll pay for it, whereas Gezel is outright robbery. But in the Pasuk, Chamas means outright robbery, and so it means by robbing from Bnei Yisrael, it's considered as if they spilled dam naki, as if they spilled innocent blood. So again, you see that Gezel is tantamount to killing. V'omer, and you have a fourth Pasuk for this, says Rabbi Yochanan. You have the story in Sefer Shmuel where there was a famine in Eretz Yisrael towards the end of David's life, and David asks the Urim V'Tumim, and he's told it's because Shaul had mistreated the Gibeonim, and then you have the whole story over there where he goes to see what to go and talk to them, what are they willing to, what will they take in compensation, and they say nothing except the lives of descendants of Shaul, and so on and so forth, the whole story over there. So the Pasuk says, Hashem says to David through the Urim V'Tumim, El Shaul, it's because the famine is because of Shaul, the and because of the house of bloodshed, because he killed the Givonim. And as the Gemara is going to explain in a couple of lines, he didn't actually kill Givonim, but he cut off their panosa, and therefore it's considered as though he killed them. You have in the Uliu and Sefer Shmuel, you have the whole story where Doyeg HaDoimi, David's arch enemy, had mastered on Achimelech the Kohen Gadol and the other Kohenim in Noiv, that they're in cahoots with David. David had gone there starving, and Achimelech gave him some lacham upon him and gave him a sword, and David put on. David pretended as though he's on a secret mission from the king, and that's why and I didn't have the chance to take my weapons because I was in a hurry, and nobody's supposed to know where I am, and Achimelech, you know, he's the Kohen Gadol, he's not involved in politics, he doesn't know the latest news that David is on the outs with Shaul. As far as he knew, David is Shaul's trusted son-in-law and general of the army and so on and so forth, so he gave it to him, but Doeg twisted that into claiming that Achimelech and company are secretly plotting with David to overthrow Shaul's kingship, and so Shaul judged him as a murdered Bamalchus, and Doeg went and killed them all. So now the Gemara explains elsewhere, the Gemara explains right here, that when he killed the Kohenim of Noiv, that also destroyed the Parnassah of the Givonim, because their job was to serve as wood choppers and water drawers for the Mishkan, and when the Kohenim were killed, then they also lost their Parnassah. Our Gemara here and in other places says that Shaul never actually killed any Givonim. It was just this matter that he deprived them of their Parnassah. There are other places, there are Midrashim, that say that when the Kohenim were being killed, that there were some Givonim that were actually caught up in the crossfire as well as collateral damage, and so some of them were actually directly killed. But our Gemara is saying that not. The point is, again, that because he interfered with their Parnassah, it's considered as though he killed them. The Gemara elsewhere, by the way, explains that the El Shol, the El Beis HaDomim, actually really means two different things. Number one, Hashem is upset, even though at Shol's command this terrible thing was done. The fact is, Shol was basically a tzaddik, and they didn't make a proper hesped for him when he was killed by the Plishtim all those years ago. And then there was also this unfinished business with the Givonim. So the Pasuk describes how David took care of both matters. He did what he could to appease the Givonim, and in the end the result was that seven of Shaul's descendants were killed, and then afterwards he had Shaul's and Yonasan's and everyone's bones reburied and made a big hesped for them. Okay, so we have four psukim illustrating this point, that when a person steals from somebody else or interferes with his parnasa, then it can be considered as though he killed him. So the Gemara says, "My v'oimer." Why do we need four different psukim? So like this, the chitema. If you only had the first pasuk as nefesh ba'olav yikach, you would think, then fine. Nefesh didei ein. Sure, if Reuven steals from Shimon, then he's taking Shimon's life. Avol nefesh bonav of noisav loy. But you could argue, how is he harming Shimon's children? So for that, you need the second pasuk, Toshma. as the pasuk says. So the second pasuk says that when the goyim steal your crops and everything, then it's considered as though they're killing the Jews' sons and daughters as well. So the gazlan should realize he's not only harming the person himself that he stole from, but also his children. You might argue, fine. So if he steals without compensating the owner, then that's a bad thing, and he's harming and he's taking away the other person's life and the life of his children, because now he doesn't want to have what to give them parnasa with. But you could argue if the person is not a gazlan, but rather a chamson, as in he pays money. He extorts the other guy to sell him, but then afterwards he does pay him. Then maybe it's loy, so then maybe it's not such a problem. So here we're understanding that here we're using chamas in the sense that it's used in Gemara, which means, as we said before, extorting the other person, forcing the other person to sell it, and then giving him, but at least then compensating him. So even if the goyim are not outright stealing from the Jews, they're only doing chamas. Nevertheless, Hashem considers it as if they spill dumb nucky. The pashtus, because not necessarily with the money are you going to be able to buy the same thing. What if prices have gone up in between? What if b'chalal you have the fact that the food is not available right there on the spot? They have to first go and buy it, like in the story of Ma'ukva and his wife. So it's still considered, so Hashem still counts it against them as though they actually spilled blood. Marashah says, let's say, for example, that they had food available and they could use it right now for their hunger, and now they can't because now all they have is money that the Chamsan gave them, and now they have to go to the store and buy more food with it, and meanwhile, they're still hungry. Even with all of that, you might argue, Hani mili heichad deka'ovid biyadayim. Sure, if the person does stealing or chamas directly with his bare hands, then yeah, he can be held responsible for taking the other person's or his children's souls. Av gromaloi, but you could argue where it was indirect, then maybe it's not so bad. No, there's for the fourth pasuk, Toshma el shol vel beis adamim ashehemis esagibonim. Now we have to ask, okay, Heichem Matsinu Shahorag Shol Esa Givonim. Where do we ever find that Shol actually killed the Givonim? So again, you have Medirashim that say that maybe a few of them were killed in the crossfire, but the Gemara here and in Yevamos and in other places is assuming that none of them were actually killed directly. But Elamitok Shahorag Noiv Irakoinim, but because at Shol's orders, they killed the Koinim of the city of Noiv, which was the city of Koinim. So you must speak him like a Mayim Mazin. Now the Kohenim would supply to the Givonim water and food, because the Givonim, ever since they first joined the Jewish people in Yeshua's times, where they tricked Yeshua and the rest of the Jewish people into thinking that they come from a faraway country and they want to make a peace treaty and the whole story over there. So Yeshua, after he found out what they had done, he gives orders that from then on they should be Choit Ve'etz and B'Shoy Ve'Mayim, wood choppers and water drawers for the Mishkan. So they were working in Noiv, and in return, the Kohenim would supply them with food. So now, though, the Kohenim have been killed, and now the Givonim have lost that. Malol of Akosav Kilo Horgon Sashem counts it, so the Posek counts it as though Shol directly killed them. So we see even where it's indirect. Marsha points out, wait a minute, the Givonim themselves are Shoyev Emayim, they're drawing water, so why do the Kohenim have to supply them with water? So he says, because listen, what happened? The Givonim, they were originally among the inhabitants of Eretz Yisrael. They lived in the city of Givon and a few neighboring cities. But now, after this whole thing, again, they played a trick on the Jewish people. They pretended they're from a faraway country. It turns out that they're locals. So now they were dispossessed from their land. They're made choit ve'etz and b'shoy v'mayim, and they have no more rights to their land anymore. Their cities are being taken over by the Jewish people, same as the rest of the cities of Eretz Yisrael. So now they don't really have a permanent place to live, so therefore they don't necessarily have springs or wells of water of their own to be able to get water, so they're going and drawing water for the Mishkan and for the Kohenim, but they don't necessarily have the ability, they don't have a place from which they can get water for themselves, so therefore the Kohenim would have to supply it to them. So again, we see that even an indirect thing like that is still held against Shol.
At the end of the Masechta, as we were mentioning yesterday, it talks about various cases where a person is selling something in small quantities, and there's a concern maybe those things were stolen from the person they worked for, or from a wife from her husband or whatever, as opposed to there are times when we can assume that it's legitimately gained. So we talked about yesterday, for example, an artist, he gets a sharecropper, he gets a certain percentage of the crop. So now he's entitled to sell his percentage of the crop and of the wood and everything, but depending on the circumstances, you have to be concerned that he might be illegally taking from his employer and selling that. So the Gemara lays down rules in the Mishnah, and the Gemara in more detail lay down rules in that connection. So the Gemara gives some examples. Tanan Rabbanan, loitchim min anoshim kleit semer bi'Yehuda. You're allowed to buy from women, you're allowed to buy woolen garments in Yehuda, in the south of Eretz Yisrael, because those are, we find in the Gemara in Ksubas, that women's usual work at home was spinning and weaving, so therefore we can assume that what they're weaving is actually, what they're selling is not something that they took from their husbands that they're not supposed to, but rather this is their own masi adayim, this is their own handicraft, and they're selling it and earning money for the family, so then that's legitimate. Or klei pishtam begalil, and similarly in the Galil, in the north of Eretz Yisrael, you can buy from them linen garments for the same reason. In Yehuda, in the south of Eretz Yisrael, was more of a sheep growing region, so therefore they had a lot more wool. In the Galil was more of a flax growing region. Avaloi yenus shmonim uslosis, but you're not allowed to buy from them wine or oil or fine flour, because those kinds of things, it actually explains, usually the man himself, usually the man of the household is going to sell them himself. He's usually not going to delegate that to his wife. So if she's selling these things, then we have a concern that she may have illegally taken it and is trying to sell it to earn money for herself and keep it from her husband. Obviously, these things are going to vary in different times and different places, but the Mishnah is giving us rules that applied in those times and those places. The Braisa, rather, is giving us rules that applied in those times and those places. When it talks about the donations for the Mishkan in Parshas Vayakel, the pasuk says Vayavoyu ha'anoshim al ha'anoshim. It says the men came up, al the women. So Rashi says that al means together with, meaning in other words, the women were the most eager to give to the Mishkan, and the men kind of like tagged along. But one of the Mephoshim there, the Sfono, says an interesting point based on this Gemara that it literally means the men had to accompany the women so they could testify and they could certify to Moshe and the other people who are accepting the donations that this is legitimate, that these women did not take things from the household that they're not supposed to. So v'loy min avodim, for the same reason you're not allowed to buy these things from avodim, because we have to be concerned that they stole from their master. V'loy min atinokas, and not from children, same thing, they may have stolen it from their parents. Abba Shol says that it's not necessarily always the case, says Abba Shol, that you can't buy certain things from women at all. A woman can sell small amounts of things enough to earn 4 or 5 dinner, which will be enough for her to buy a tichel for her head. So that's a legitimate thing. We don't assume that's something illegal. However, in all these cases, if the seller tells you, so now she explains, in other words, when she's going to buy for 4 or 5 dinner, a tichel, her husband's not going to be machped on that small amount. So even if he didn't specifically give her permission, we assume that it's fine, says Abishol. However, any of these cases, if the seller tells you, hide what you just bought, then it's also because then we have good reason to assume that it's illegal. Why would they be telling you to hide it? So the Braita continues, Gaboit Zdokka, Loitchim Mehen Dover Mort, where Gaboit Zdokka, who are going around and collecting Zdokka from people, you're allowed to buy from them small things, because then they have small things that they may be selling in order to earn a little more money for the Zdokka Pushka. Avaloi Dover Meruba, but not large things, because that might be that they're doing illegal business with Zdokka funds or with things that they collected for Zdokka. The other way around, actually. It doesn't mean to buy from the Gebotsdokker. It means the Gebotsdokker themselves, by the same token, when they're collecting from houses, when they're going around from house to house and collecting, they can buy small amounts, but not, they can take a small amount, but not large amounts. Small amounts, we assume that the Baal HaBayis is not makbid on. Larger amounts, not. There's actually a story in that connection in the Yerushalmi. One time, a couple of the Chachamim were going around from house to house collecting tzedakah. They came to the house of a guy named Bar Burian, who was known to be a rich guy, a guy like that, they can expect to get a decent sized nedarah from. But they happen to be passing by, they overhear him talking with his son. He's going to send his son to the store to buy vegetables. So the son asks, what kind should I buy? So Bar Burian tells him, buy the cheaper kind that are left over from yesterday. They're cheaper. You can get more bundles per the same amount of money. So they think to themselves, it looks like this guy's a bit of a kamtsen for his household expenses. Not necessarily are we going to get much from him. We'll go to the other houses. We'll come back to him afterwards and see if we get anything over there. So they go around to the other houses in town. They continue collecting tzedakah. Eventually, they come back to his house, and he's out in his garden working. And they ask him, can you maybe give a nedava for the tzedakah that we're collecting for? So he tells them, go to the house and then ask my wife. Tell my wife that I said that she should give you a container full of coins, a container full of gold coins. So they go and talk to the wife. She says, did my husband say what size container? Did he say a small one or a large one? They say, we don't know. He didn't tell us. She says, I'll tell you what. I'll give you a large one. If that's what my husband meant, then good. And if not, then I'll deduct it from my ksuba. So they take that and they go back to Bar Burian to thank him, and he asks them, so what size did my wife give you? They tell him the large thing, and they tell him what she said. She says, good, that was actually exactly I wanted her to give a large one. I'm very happy with that. And then they ask him, so what happened? He asks them how come you came to me last? It's already late in the day. And they tell him that, oh, they had overheard his conversation with his son before, and he explains to them, for myself, I can be cheap. We can eat vegetables from yesterday, big deal. When it comes to tzedakah, you can't skimp on tzedakah. So this is an example of this kind of thing. They went to the wife, but only after making sure that the husband gave permission. So the same thing. They got boyd stucker, then they're allowed to take from the wives a small amount, but not a large amount from the avodim or whatever. A small amount, but not a large amount, because we don't know whether that's legitimate. Ba'badodin, similarly, when you have people who have olive presses. So they press olives, and they also sell olive oil afterwards. So the same kind of thing. Leuchten mehen zeis, so there it's the other way around. Leuchten mehen zeis in bemida, the shemen bemida. You can buy large quantities of olives or large quantities of oil from them in measurements, meaning in containers of measure, because it's a large amount. So whoever's there, the guy's wife or children or whatever, there's no way they're going to be able to sell a large amount and expect to be able to hide it from their husband or father. So therefore, if they're selling a large amount, then it's more likely that that's legitimate. But not a small amount of olives or a small amount of oil, because that they might be taking and figuring they can get away with it because he's not going to notice the difference. Rashi gives another explanation. The word mu'at can be related to the word maton. A maton is a large bucket. Before they press the olives, they would put them into a bucket for them to heat up by being in a big pile over there in the bucket and soften, and that way you'll get more oil out of them. Now, it's not normal to sell them directly out of the bucket. You sell them either before they're pressed, or you sell the olive oil after it's pressed. So therefore, if they're selling directly from the maton, it's more likely that there's funny business going on over here. The Braisa continues, Reb Shimon Gamliel the 11th, Loksim Minoshim Zaysim Bemoyed or Bemuat Begolil Elyon. Reb Shimon Gamliel says, in the upper Golil, the mountainous areas of the Golil, like Tzfas and Miron, and the rest of that area, you would be allowed to buy from women small amounts of olives. Bemoyed would mean doing chalamoyed when you're doing less work anyway. Bemoyed means smaller amounts. The Golil Elyon, that was a big olive growing area. Shepa'amim, Odom Bosh, Limker, Pesach Beise, because Reb Shimon Gamliel says sometimes a person is embarrassed to sell these small amounts in front of his house, so he gives it to his wife and delegates to her to sell small amounts. So therefore, that's a legitimate thing, and therefore there's no concern that she's doing it, again, that she's doing it behind her husband's back. Okay, so the Gemara continues. So those are various basic dinim in this connection. And again, the Gemara brings various braises and various statements that talk about a lot of other similar such cases, when you're allowed versus not allowed to buy, when it's more likely that it's stolen goods versus when not. Now, one of the things we said was the gaboy tzedakah. We said they're allowed to collect from the wives small amounts, but not large amounts. So the Gemara tells in this connection, Ravina ikla lebei mechuzah. Ravina was a gaboy tzedakah. He one time visited the city of Mechuza. Also, Noshi de Bei Mechuza, the women of Mechuza came to give him tzedakah, Romu Kamei Kavli Vashiri. And they piled up in front of him necklaces and bracelets. So they were giving him their jewelry. Kavli Minayu, and Ravina accepted it from them for tzedakah. Omale Rabba Tisfal Ravina. So Rabba Tosfa and Ravina were both among the last Amoraim. We talk about Ravina and Rav Ashi are the end of the Gemara, and in particular, you had two Ravinas. The second one, when he passed away, the period of the Gemara is officially, the period of the Amoraim is officially over, and Rabba Tosfa was also one of the Chachamim of that generation. So Rabba Tosfa says to Ravina, "V'hotanya, didn't we learn in the Brisa Gabor Tzedakah Makabel Mehem Dava Mu'at Avoloi Dava Meruva? Didn't we say that the Gabor Tzedakah are supposed to be accepting from the women only small amounts, not large amounts? So how are you accepting all this jewelry from them?" Amalei, so Ravina answers him, "Hani, Ravina Mechuza Dava Mu'at Ninu. You know what? For the people of Mechuza who are very rich, these kinds of things are considered a small thing." And we find in various places in the Gemara that the people of Mechuza were very rich, and the women over there were extremely pampered and fond of fine jewelry or whatever. There was actually an expression, Rava, in the generation, a couple of generation or two before that. Rava was the Rosh Yeshiva in Mechuza. He had one of the central yeshivas of Bavel that was located in Mechuza. Rava, in a different Gemara, says about the women of Mechuza that in effect they're robbing from, they're stealing from their husbands, not literally, but in the sense that, in other words, they don't work. They basically just apparently like sit around the house or go to parties or whatever, and so they're not contributing to the family income. And in that sense, like they're stealing from their husbands, and also because they have expensive tastes, then it means that sometimes their husbands may figure they have to steal or whatever in order to satisfy their wives' tastes. Nevertheless, so Ravina is saying over here, the fact is they are rich, and for them, relative to them, this kind of thing is a dover mort.
The women approached them as opposed to the Gabbai Tzedakah going to the women.
Well, this is true. Well, I mean, Ravina came to town and announced that he's collecting Tzedakah, and then they all came, but yeah. On the side over here, there's a piece from Ein Ol Yohu, one of the Mefoshim on Ein Yaakov that discusses you have the whole matter of Yush Shalom Midas, the famous sugya in Bav Metzia, which here we're going to be starting to learn Bav Metzia either today or tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem, and you have the famous sugya over there about Yush Shalom Midas. So, and the halacha is Yush Shalom Midas is not valid Yush. So fine, eventually the husbands are going to find out that their wives gave the tzedakah and they're going to be happy with it, but we don't know to begin with. So that they are. So how does that work? So he talks about that. He discusses a bit of lumdus over here. How such a thing can work. Whether he definitely wants it to happen or not. Then that can factor into your shalomi das over here. Okay. So the upshot was again that Ravina is allowed to accept all this jewelry from them. So the Gemara continues. The Gemara finishes off. Now, one of the other things, one of the points related to this that's discussed at the end of the Masechta is like this. You have a craftsman working for you, and you hire somebody for a job, and sometimes there's going to be leftovers and waste from the job. What is the din of those things? When does he have to return it to you versus when can he keep it? Say, for example, you hire somebody to saw wood for you. You're going to have sawdust. Can he keep the sawdust for himself, or does he have to return it to you? So it goes through and discusses various dinim in this regard. The Mishnah discusses a couple of them. You have here today's Chof Cheshvan. You have a story in that connection involving the Rebbe Rashab, the famous story where he, when he was a little kid, one time they made for him a new suit. They hired a tailor to make him a new suit. And then after, when they're fitting him for the suit, the Rebbe Rashab reaches into the guy's pocket and finds over there a piece of material from the material that was supposed to have been used for the suit. And la halacha, the tailor was supposed to return it afterwards to the family. They could conceivably use it for somebody else, and he was trying to keep it for himself. So he's extremely embarrassed and starts making excuses. Kitzur HaMaisa, afterwards you have the continuation of the story that the Rebbe Rashab later on goes to the Rebbe Maharash, to his father, he doesn't tell him the actual story. He just tells him if one yid caused another yid embarrassment, then what's his tikkun for it? And they asked him, why don't you tell the background of the story? He says, bad enough I embarrassed the guy, I'm not going to say Lashon Hara about him too. So the Gemara goes into various details about that. When, for example, what size material, let's say, would this tailor in the story have been entitled to keep for himself? Because the family is not necessarily going to get any use out of it, versus what size would he have to give it to them, and they could use it for something else. So the Gemara says, Tana Rabbanan, Mitzatasei Avonim, people who carve stones. You have you carve out, you hew stones from a quarry. They have to be shaped into. They have to be shaped and they have to be chiseled into the proper shape. So chiselers of stones, Ein Behem Mishum Gezel. Then there's no issue of gezel. They are allowed to keep the little chips of stone that come off. Speaking of the Rebbe Maharash, there's a Rishima from him where he discusses the point that we know when Moshe carved out the luchas, the Eibishter tells him, psal lucha, that the psalas, the leftovers, will be yours. So the Rebbe Maharash talks about that in light of our Gemara over here. The question is, if we're saying that there's no gezel involved, then why does Hashem have to give Moshe specific permission to keep those chips? He'd be allowed to keep them anyway, based on this Gemara. There's a difference whether the Gemara is going to say there's a difference whether Balabais makbid aleihen or not. Anyway, the Rebbe Maharash mentions in the Surah Shema, he explains that on the one hand, no matter where it is, it's all in the reshus of the Balabais, because Maloy Kolaritz Kavoda, the Eibishter is everywhere. On the other hand, the fact is the carving of the luchos was being done down here on earth, and they were made out of snapperinun, which is a sapphire, which is a precious stone. So therefore, that kind of thing, the chips b'derech klal wouldn't belong to the stone cutter. Because it's one thing plain stone, but they were talking about sapphire, which is a precious material. So therefore, the Eibishter had to give him specific permission. And when the Rashbats, the famous Chosid, the Rashbats asked the Maharash on that, wait a minute, we're talking about, again, it's in Maloy Kolaritz Kavoyde, it's in the Eibishter's Rishus, no matter what. What's the difference, sapphire or any other kind of material, than the Rebbe Maharash says? The fact is, it is down here on earth, and therefore we have to look at it from the point of view of Bosa Badam, where sapphire is a precious stone, and therefore Hashem has to give him special permission for it. There's a Sikha in Chelik Yud Tes, Ahad, which is a Sikha on Parshas Ekev, which is also a Hadron on Bava Kama, where the Rebbe discusses that Rishima at length and discusses things about it. For one thing, the Rebbe points out there would be a difference between where you're talking about. For example, in Eretz Yisrael versus Bavel and the desert. In Eretz Yisrael, they would build with stones, so chips of stone would mean something over there. In Bavel, they didn't have stones, as we know from Parshas Noach. That's why they had to invent bricks. So therefore, even if you do happen to get a hold of stone over there, then the chips of stone don't really mean much, and therefore you can keep them, which is why the Braisa is saying Ein Behem Mishum Gezel. And so the Rebbe discusses in that regard the same thing in the Midbar. Nobody's building with stone either, and therefore the stone chips are not going to matter much unless they're sapphire, and therefore that's why since in that case it was sapphire, then Hashem has to give him special permission to keep it. And the Rebbe goes on over there with Harira from it about Moshe receiving the Torah and giving us the pilpul of it, which also represents that Moshe was able to keep the psoilus, but he generously shared it with us, and so on and so forth. It's a whole hadron over there. Anyway, so the Gemara continues. The Braisa continues. Mefas geilonis, people who are tree surgeons, where you have there's too many branches on the tree, and you cut out individual ones. Rashi points out the word pisug is related to a word that means skipping over, like you cut out every other branch. So mefasge gufanim, similarly people who do the same kind of thing, pruning off extra branches from grapevines. Menakfi higi. And similarly, people who cut off branches from thorn bushes, Rashi, the word nikuf, Rashi points out, also means cutting off, but it's a word more appropriate to thorn bushes. The pashtus, Rashi brings from a pasuk, the nikaf sivcha yad b'mazel, the pashtus, because like you do it more indiscriminately with a tree or a grapevine, you're going to have to do it carefully so you don't harm good branches, but if it's a thorn bush, then you can do it more, then you can do it more like slashing, so that would be nakfi. Similarly, menakshe zroyim, people who are weeding between seeds. You have seeds planted in the ground. You have weeds growing among, or not just weeds. You have actually you have the vegetables are planted too thickly, and you need to thin them out so that they can grow properly. So that's menakshe zroyim. The odre yirokas, and similarly, people who are hoeing by vegetables. Same idea when they're too close together, then you pull out every other one. So menakshe zroyim would mean, in other words, if you have other plants, whether weeds or whatever, growing between them, odre yirokas would mean where the vegetables themselves were planted in too great a concentration, and now you have to thin them out. So now the question is, can the worker keep those things? Can he keep the branches that he cut off? Can he keep the vegetables that he pulled out to make the other ones grow better or whatever? So bizman shabalabais makbid alayan, when the balabais is makbid and wants to keep those things, yesh ben mishrum gezel, then there is a matter of gezel, and then you're not allowed to keep them. Ein balabais makbid alayan. If the balabais doesn't matter, doesn't mind, harei el shaloi, then you're allowed to keep them. Omer of Yehuda, so Rabbi Yehuda says in this connection, kishus, hops, that are they're a plant that grows parasitically on other plants, and they would use them in those times when they use them even nowadays when they're making beer. So they're a plant. They have a use, but not really much of one. So that the choses and green unripe grain, you planted grain and it's still green and unripe, and you would use it for animal food. Ein behem mishum gezel. There's no issue of gezel in them. Now, on the face of it, what does that mean? I mean, the person might want the kshus and the choses for himself. So the Maharshal says maybe we're talking about, let's say, for example, the kshus that kind of grows by itself. The choses, maybe we're also talking about it grew by itself, and it's not going to develop into mature grain anyway, so therefore there's not as much of an issue. The Rashba gives a different explanation. The Rashba explains, choses is one of those things. You have the animal nibble on it, you have animals nibble on it, and it'll cause the grain afterwards to grow better. So therefore, when the owner is not machbid, namely he doesn't have any animals of his own, then go ahead, send your animals over there, let them nibble on the choses, and then the owner will be happy because it'll make the grain grow better afterwards. But if he has animals of his own, he'd rather feed them the choses. So then you have no business taking it for yourself. So therefore, so ein behem mishum gezel. But again, ba'asra de kafti, in a place where they're machbid, yesh behem mishum gezel, and there is an issue of gezel of taking these hops or the green grain.
We have to list every single material.
And we don't have to list every single material, but we're mentioning these kinds of things. So again, shus and choses basically just grow on their own. So therefore, we can point out that unlike most crops, there's not an issue of gezel in them unless people are makbid. Omer Ravina, and Ravina finishes off, Umasa Machasya Astra Dekaptihu. You should know, Masa Machasya, the name of a city in Babel, was a suburb of Sura, is a place where they are makbid. Rashi says because Mosse Machasya is a place where they had a lot of animals and they needed good grazing, good pasture for the animals. Marsha points out an interesting point over here. The Masechta itself, a lot of times the Masechta ends on a good note. Most books of Tanakh do. In general, we try to end on a good note. But here we have the Masechta ends, Asra de Kapti, or it's a place where people are makbid, which doesn't seem to be a very good thing. Now fine, the reason for it is because technically Bava Kama is not the end of a Masechta, it's actually the three Babas to a certain extent are considered one long Masechta. Nevertheless, Rashi decides to end it on a good note. He doesn't just say Tzrichim Lemira that they need pasture. He says Tzrichim Lemira Toiv, they need good pasture, and that way he ends off with the word Toiv. In that same sicha from which you have the mugadika part that went into the Kurta Sicha, it's about the Hadron of the Satsa Abonim that ever goes on in the unmugadika part in Teres Menachem, and explains that still, why does the Gemara finish off with these people of Mosse Machasya being Machbid? It still seems to be not a very good way to end the Masechta. The reason is because Fakert, it means these people, they were Machbid to, like we said before, a person, you have the famous expression that Tzadikim are Chov Valem Mamonim Yosem Gufam, and Ain Pushtin, Ain Begezel, they won't even do the slightest trace of Gezel. So the people of Mosse Machasya were of that caliber, and therefore they were careful, even about Chus V'Chozes, even about these parasitic chemical plants or whatever that grow on their own, or unnecessary plants that grow on their own, because they know they can use them for a purpose which ultimately will help in their avodah and therefore their makbid. So it's not a negative thing, fakir, it's a positive thing that they realize the value of even the smallest things, and they're not just going to allow people to go and take them willy-nilly. Slikim Masech to Baba Kachma. Yom Yom Mashiach Ogo'ola. So we don't have to list every single thing, but we have to list, for example, these kinds of plants that grow. No, but so that's why. So Ravina wants. So on the surface, Ravina is giving an example. I'll give you an example of a place where they're makfid. According to the Sicha of the Rebbe, the point is that the point is there that Ravina wants to highlight how great the people of Masa Machasya were, that they were careful even about such things that many people would consider unimportant. Okay, Yom Yom Mashiach Ogo'ola Chav Cheshven. Being that it's the Rebbe Rashab's birthday, so the Rebbe Rashab writes in one of his Maimorim, we know there are Ramach Mitzvahs Eseh, and it kind of corresponds to Ramach Evre Aguf. So that means, what happens? So it means the chayus of a person's body in general, and the chayus of each individual limb comes from, of course, each limb through a person doing a mitzvah, or through the mitzvah itself, which is Elikus, through that comes to him Chayus, and that's how he lives. So when Mashiach comes, we will actually see how the life force of all the limbs of the body is from Elikus. Continuing with halachas of the Beit HaKiseh, we were talking about that a person has to act in a tzniyasik way as far as uncovering himself, and as far as not talking when he's in there, etc. So now, if a person is going to the bathroom out in the open, then he has to stay away far enough from other people that nobody will see the parts of him that are uncovered. So he doesn't have to stay so far away that nobody will see him at all, but even if somebody sees him from a distance, standing there, then that doesn't matter as long as they can't see his actual uncovered skin. So then if he's behind a fence, then he can go right away. Then he doesn't have to worry because then he's out of people's sight altogether. And the same thing if he's in a backyard or something, it doesn't even matter. Somebody else hears him passing wind. That doesn't matter because that's not a lack of sneeze. Most people are embarrassed that other people should hear them breaking wind. But if a particular person is not embarrassed, then it doesn't matter. He's not makbid, then that's fine. And we find, in fact, in the time of the Gemara, we find that people were not makbid on such things, and therefore there's no problem with that. The problem is only with other people seeing the uncovered parts of his body.